our fish don't know anything about water. That's their environment.
Most people don't know what business they're in because that's their environment. Well, when you say you're selling sound, you're also selling them the means of knowing what business they're in.
No, I was making that point just for the idea that this is what they're paying for. They're not paying me for consultation. They're paying me for soundtrack. They're paying a very high price, more than they ever paid for any soundtrack before.
But they're paying for a special quality of sound that makes them more aware, or the customer more aware of something. You're selling really the means of knowing, self-awareness or product awareness. I don't know if we can invent a proper term for this or not.
No, I'm thinking of it not in relation to my problem. I'm thinking of it in relation to our problem.
Yeah.
Of what can we?
What if we?
If we go to them and say, look, I'm gonna, you know, if you went to them and say, look, I'm gonna give you advice that you are not aware of, but if you took this advice, it might be the difference between you going down the wrong road for 20 years or down the right road.
Well, in other words, we're really in the business of environments. And of making people conscious of their environments.
Yeah, my point is that over and above the consultancy and the dialogue, and these are very necessary antecedents, what you have to do is give them some of the blueprint of the environment which you're providing.
Well, that is
which you're helping them discover.
But that is an anti-environment. That's another environment. You create a little environment that enables them to see the other environment in which they're lost. The dialogue, the consulting, is actually a means, just like the artist making the ordinary human being conscious of his world. The consultant deals with the business as an art form. He turns the man's business into an art process.
Well, I'm trying to handle this in the realm of what can we, you know, when you go to a person, you have a hard job saying to him, I mean, you know, they'll pay you how much for a consultancy?
I don't know.
In a very funny way. Here, this Sports Illustrated will pay you more for your reading your words than Herb Brown will pay you to come and speak to his people about their whole damn business. So the question is, what? And it's because they have something they can touch, that they can put a bill on, they can paste a bill onto it, and so forth. Now, what can we do in relation to?
But any consultancy always finalizes as some concrete expression of that consultancy. When I go to IBM, I design courses. But when I design courses, there is continuity there, there are lesson guides and whatnot. There is a product, there is a package, which is the end result. And I think that any consultancy with Norm Ross or Xerox or whatnot, yes, the dialogue is basic. The exchange is basic. The new directions are basic. But over and above that, I think they expect, and this is why I think the fusion of your two brands of expertise is very important here.
Well, also, you see, what Tony is reminding us of is that we are not aware of what business we're in.
That's
very helpful because it reminds us that we are also in a new environment of which we're not sufficiently conscious in order to have a name for it. Media consulting really is consulting about environments because media are environments and they are invisible. Our consulting is all very occult because it's about that which is unseen, invisible. So we are, in a sense, as far as the ordinary business world is concerned, we're entirely in the world of the occult, the hidden factors in their business.
This is perhaps a... I spoke to Marshall about the fact that ultimately, even though each one of us has his own little business, that for this common and collaborative venture, we may have to have another little firm. He had one in Toronto once under the general denomination of media consultants.
Oh, no, the old business I had was Idea Consultants.
Well,
but this, now I'm trying to get the telephone company to accept the phrase media consultants as a listing. But they, is there such a heading in the New York directory, media consultants?
I don't know, but if it is, it would be someone that tells you where to place your ads.
Yes.
Exactly. I see, all right.
That's right.
All right, space. Space selling. And time and space. For your world, it would be time. Sound is time, not space. But, we'll think about it. We've got to get back and put in some phone calls before lunch.
I mean, a point I was trying to get at is what, you know, when you go to these people, the problem generally is that the minute you open your mouth, you've given them your product.
Sure.
I mean, you've that's given why them you your can product in every speech you've given
that's
in your
why.
Book already.
You can, but you can't give them your perception. You can give them the concept, but you can't give them the percept. And the percept requires training. Concept, you just pick it up by ear, but the perceptions take training. You know, in your own field of sound, you can give them an idea, but that doesn't mean they have the slightest control or understanding. That takes time. That's a training of the sensory life. So this is where the environment world is also very much concerned with the training of the sensory life. And in our kind of electronic world, the training of senses becomes indispensable. Now, I discovered some time ago that these businessmen can't use my stuff without a lot of preliminary training. They can't take it. They can't lift it from you. There isn't any way they can get hold of it.
In other words, I'm not afraid of plagiarism at all, any more than anybody's going to plagiarize you, Tony. I heard you say the other day to a group, it's not that I'm any more talented. It's not so. You are enormously more talented because you are enormously more perceptive. And these are the things that cannot be plagiarized. These are the things that cannot be pillaged. Now, what we started here this morning, we need to carry on. I just remind the three of us that Norman Ross, this is just exploratory, and all we're going to listen to, we're going to listen to him principally to see what his problems are and what suggestions he has as how to use us.
They remember that get the other guy's headaches as fast as you can because they're full of untouched potential. You can rewire his headache so that it yields tremendous new wealth.
It's like the bad marks in the school are really an area of the teaching problems, whereas the good marks are just the icing on the cake that they praise themselves with.
Well, we'll work on this, Tony.
You had a funny story. This is a true story. My cousin's son is the valedictorian of his high school out in Long Island. My cousin went to the principal the other day, and he said, you know, the only two times you've ever spoken to the valedictorian of your class is to tell him that his hair was too long. Only two words he ever said to him, the only two times he ever spoke, was to call him into the office and say, your hair is too long.
That's par for the course, as they say. And I think we do this to our closest friends. And formed an amazingly organic plan for an encyclopedia, which Newman took over for his idea of a university. Hence, Newman rejected outright the whole 19th century value in education on subjects. He said the real university is the city. It is a place of dialogue, of encounter, of exchange. And the old word university, you know, came out of the world of Meister Eckhart, and the phrase was university of being. The whole of being was thought of as the university. Newman extended this idea to the city. Now, under electronic conditions, the Newman ideal is not only capable of realization, but of being transcended many times. But the one thing you don't need under electronic means of access, the one thing you don't need is a subject, algebra, history, or anything else. Instead, you can substitute for any subject the process by which it came into existence. Let me give an illustration. With Gutenberg and the stepping up of the visual life to high intensity, as compared with the old manuscript culture, the entire world suddenly was transformed into a rear-view mirror, and what we call the sense of modern history was born. The past became suddenly very visible in the rear-view mirror of print. And an obsession with the past became characteristic of that first age of printing.
This explains a great deal of the literature of that time, including people like Hamlet. Look on this picture and on that. Look on that noble gentleman, my father of yesteryear, and look at this horrible thing now. Hamlet, like all the revengers out of the Revenger tragedy, was a man alienated from the present. The first age of print had the effect of alienating the whole population from the present and obsessing them with the human past. This reached its peak in Milton's Paradise Lost, where the whole of human society became a rearview mirror to look at the Garden of Eden. It's really a fantastic illusion that the function of human life is to be a rearview mirror for some distant past event. It reached a sort of parody of itself in the next century with the Graveyard School of Poetry, with everybody meditating on the graves, on the past, and the mute and glorious Miltons and Cromwell's guiltless of their country's blood, using the dead present as a rearview mirror. It ended suddenly with the coming of the landscape poetry of the Romantics, in which nature was used not as a mirror for the past, but as the mirror for the mind of man. It sort of liberated people from history. After centuries of this rearview mirror, the mind of man was suddenly mirrored in nature and was liberated from history, or the historical obsession. Now, the rearview mirror is sometimes called the learning theory that we have to go from the known to the unknown. In fact, this means that whenever you encounter the known, the unknown, you translate it into what you already know. In other words, you avoid it. The only person who dare encounter the unknown, the new, directly, the Gorgon, without a mirror, is the artist. Artists in any age are experts in direct encounter with the present, and they report their probings and findings in all sorts of grotesque designs. What the pop artists are telling us, you see, is that the environment itself has now become a work of art. That is a direct probe of a new electronic situation. The report is completely misunderstood. People are standing around classifying their endeavors as if it was the content of their endeavors that had to be judged. What they're desperately trying to tell us is something has happened. We live now in a new kind of world. We are now responsible for the environment. We're not responsible for the contents of the museum. That's quite a big flip over. It's like saying to the scientist, we don't want proof anymore. We want prediction. Proof is, after all, based on classification and repetition. It's rearview mirror. Prediction is what is needed at a very fast-moving jet paced period. We do not need proofs, we need predictions. Accurate predictions. That kind of revolution is taking place right under our noses. But the obsession with the rearview mirror is still built into our whole educational establishment. Now, one way out of it is simply to understand how we got into it. That's a sort of psychiatric procedure. Understand the process by which you got trapped, and you're out. Literally. This is Edgar Allan Poe's discovery in The Philosophy of Composition. The way to solve any problem, he said, is to start at the point where it has been solved and then go back to the point you would have to begin in order to solve it. In other words, you reverse ordinary procedures. But the artist is the only person who is prepared to face the present and therefore to tell us about the future, because as our friend Father Calkins and my friend Jerry Fagan says, the future of the future is the present. This is always true. But very few people dare look at the present. And I don't think it comes easy to people in any period. Never heard of anybody except artists who could do it. And the artist does it because he's prepared to use his senses as scientific instruments, instead of just using them as pickup devices for his own satisfaction. He is engaged in a critique of satisfaction. He's willing to put aside or reject all satisfaction in order to discover and probe. One of the most exciting things that ever happened to my 15-year-old daughter in grade 11 was joining a team of children who were asked to devise a new educational system that would include the modern world and adapt it to the old educational curriculum. They were also asked to design an environment and architecture for such an enterprise. They were given months. And there were several teams in Toronto and several teams in Rochester, and they finally got together to share notes. One of the things that made this so exciting to them was the knowledge that nobody knew the answers. You see, if those kids had been given a job for which any answers existed at all, they could never have participated in it with any conviction. It's like a rigged quiz show. As long as people think the show's live, they're involved. The moment they hear it's rigged, they're out. But you give children today live problems for which adults do not know the answers, and they'll work like fury. They have vast resources in any town of this continent to use, and they, above all, delight in exchanging their discoveries and dialoguing. You've all heard of the Hawthorne experiment. There's a recent paperback on it called Hawthorne Revisited. At the Hawthorne Electric Plant near Chicago, experiments were carried out in which the workers were given a great many opportunities to prescribe what sort of environment would you like to work in. More leisure, more heat, less heat, more light, more sound, less sound, so on. They were allowed to program the environment on an experimental basis to find out what happened. To the amazement of the experimenters, no matter what they did to the environment, work performance went up, 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 whether the environment was improved or worsened. They came to the conclusion that people just liked a little attention, and they're wrong. What these people were absolutely thrilled by was the fact that they were engaged in a discovery process, and their work and their learning had become one thing. The discovery of a means of merging work and learning in one form releases untold energies in ordinary people. This is when those two forms are split apart, there's great frustration and defeat of energy. But when work and learning and discovery merge, then there's tremendous release of energy. We live in an electronic environment where this is quite easy to arrange, where people don't have to be pigeonholed and fitted into slots and categories and taught by stenciling and so on. However, I'm not suggesting that we should at once launch into this at all. I'm simply probing and inviting you to do likewise. I have a lot... here's a curious thing. I find that while I hold this microphone in my hand, I can't look at my notes. And I had a fixed microphone last night, no trouble looking at my notes. But so I'm going to skip the rest of my notes and turn it right back to Father. Thanks very much.
Well, you know, just take one of the probes home and change the neighborhood. There's no luck, Corey. I think I'll keep all my promises to Mrs. McLuhan about husbanding your energies and all that sort of business. Just one clue on how to read McLuhan. We have the manuscript, that thing you did, Understanding Media, you know, the first mimeograph thing that the government. And there were four of us who were in the process of going stir crazy, as you do in these submarines under the Arctic ice caps and things like that. And we took this Understanding Media, which was in mimeograph form, held together by paper clips, and we just split it up. And we met every day for 2 hours after having read a piece of it. And we talked. And we fought and we said, no, he's nuts. And we crossed stuff out. So that's one probe, you know, that just didn't get there. Keep moving. There's plenty more, you know. You can start in the middle of the book, at the end of the book, any old place. But like I said, it's only a book with quotation marks about it. It's fuel for a fire. and get four or five people around the fire. Don't read it in the corner because you'll have nobody to get mad at or to thrill with at the insights that you come along. Because it's there, man, and right, thanks.
And as promised, I would like to hear comments from Marshall McLuhan, our guest, on the whole business of advertising in television, what role that plays, in what way that might be. Is an advertising message, is the medium the message there, or is the message important, and in what way?
Advertising is really part of the information service industries, and increasingly the ad becomes a substitute for the product. As the information improves, as you get better information about ads, they become more and more a substitute for the products. All the satisfactions now come from the ads, not the products.
Now, how so? Can you give an example of that?
Well, it's been discovered by the advertising surveys that the people who read and pay attention to the ads are the ones who already own the products, because they're still trying to squeeze more satisfaction out of what they already own. That's why they read about the motor car they already own. But anyway, the natural tendency, as you improve the level of information about anything, is for the satisfaction to come from the information area. The hardware is becoming, and the hard sell, are becoming less and less important in our world as we become more and more involved in information. We make our environment out of information as well as all our products.
Now, if that were proved that people only paid attention to those ads, that they already own the product.
Not only.
Oh,
but mostly.
I wonder, because advertising would collapse, I would think, if that were
the case. Does this mean that we should go back to the old kind of ads we had, where all we used to do is list all of the various things instead of using color and picture?
No, I don't think it means anything, except that it's very interesting to understand what's happening. I don't try to draw any conclusions from these observations. I'm not sure that anything follows from. I work in an exploratory way in the whole field of events and in the happenings. I simply try to find out what is happening. And since it concerns everybody, it seems to me my personal point of view of what concerns everybody is not that important. Why should I insist upon some decisive or even moralistic approach to something that it concerns everybody just as much as it concerns me?
That's partly what's baffling about you, because I think people brought up and socially imprinted with our culture expect you
point
to come forth in an academic way and make a point of view.
The older,
this baffles.
The older culture, the older fragmented and specialist culture, encouraged everybody to have a point of view and to maintain it consistently. In our fast-moving information world, it's more, I think, useful to probe, explore, find out what's happening.
It's interesting, maybe to have opinions instead of convictions. Somebody once said the luxury of intellect was you could hold opinions instead of convictions, because opinions you're free to change and convictions you're stuck with. And you apparently go for opinions, and you're willing to change them as indicated.
I can change them right in the middle of an interview.
I've seen you do that.
If you don't attempt to draw conclusions, though, do you attempt nevertheless to see directions? In other words, where do you think we're going?
Well, for example, these youngsters who tell me we're not interested in goals and objectives, we just want to know what's going on in the world. I've been told that by all sorts of university students. We're not a goal-oriented generation. What they're trying to say is, we don't work from any one position in this kind of world we're living in. We're all over the place. Therefore, to have to spend our whole lives aiming at one objective is unbearable. Most businessmen today are dropouts, too. They want to quit after 10 years. And a small measure of success, they say, I couldn't go on doing this the rest of my life. I'm going back to school.
You say dropping out is going to increase rather than decrease now.
Oh, yeah. Dropoutism simply means the rejection of highly specialist goals in favor of a larger field of operations.
It's not just laziness, then.
Oh, no, it's the bright people who drop out fastest.
Very interesting.
Oh, dear, what you have just done.
Does this tie in at all with the desire now to do things instead of to be things? In other words, to be a doctor or an attorney is different from practicing medicine and practicing law. Is it possible our young people want more now to be a dynamic entity of doing things rather than to have a label and say, I am a writer?
That's right. They don't want a category. That's why that's, I think, even part of the meaning of LSD. They would rather get rid of what they have been given as a private identity then go on with that little label or lapel sticker. They won't accept that kind of thing as a real personality. And so they just wipe it out, or scrub the old tape.
Now, in view of this, let me ask you for an opinion, not a conviction, or a point of view, if you will. In view of all the rapidly flowering, explosively flowering technology and the drugs and the situation that we find ourselves in now, so rapidly changing, is human destiny bright or gloomy in your mind? Are we going to survive this and benefit from it, or are we going to go under?
Well, you can see that what is presenting the crisis is actually an enormous improvement of human facilities and human technologies. The potential in there is enormous. It's perhaps more than we deserve. that we could simply make a tremendous thing of this if we really settled down to solving it. But if we try to apply some simple blueprint, some simple-minded solution, we might be in for real trouble. I think we're going to have to have tremendous ingenuity and wisdom. Oh, yeah. Not just ingenuity, not just know-how anymore, but real wisdom is indicated for the coming world.
Will that wisdom come from people who are goal-oriented or who are role-oriented?
Well, at least the comprehensivists like Rocky Fuller, I think, have a better chance of being some use to us.
Ah. Now, we'll be back in just a moment. The time now is 55 after the hour. I've put this on my finger here just in case you have forgotten. Here is Barbara to remind you of a special event this week.
Yes, Hugh. This is the last week of Rexall's Summer Savings Spectacular.
Barbara was wondering earlier about what your opinion is of how schools will change in the future to meet these needs that are new.
Well, the general direction indicated is to switch from instruction to discovery. That is, when the kids live in a world that is practically made of information, it seems rather odd to go into a schoolroom where there's a considerable dearth of information. And to await the sort of stenciling of the mind or the stenciling of information onto the brain pan. But the possibility of using the school situation as a basis for discovery of teams of students working on problems for which answers are not known at all.
You think this will happen?
I think this ought to be tried. I'm not sure whether it will happen. I think it ought to be tried. I think the youngsters are dying to get out and solve problems that adults don't know the answers to.
Our guest, Marshall McLuhan, a man who would rather probe and explore than merely make predictions or cram everything that he does into an academic framework, and I appreciate his being here this morning. A real pleasure to meet you,
sir. He's a cool man because he's involved.
Understanding Media, the Extensions of Man, is the most recent book by Marshall McLuhan, and I hope we can get him back here sometime. Would you come back again, sir?
I would.
Thank you. We'll take a station break now.
For the rest of human history, the single biggest occupation of people's time, and therefore the single biggest industrial moneymaker, is going to be information, communication, and education through a variety of media. Therefore, if we're going to know something about living intelligently and this sort of thing, we should understand media. McLuhan understands media. Tell them about the media, Marshall.
The telephone, you see, has this mysterious property that while using it, it's very difficult to visualize anybody, and on the contrary, it also creates the idea that you are securely alone and isolated. But the absence of this visual completion, for example, when listening to radio, you have a visual image all the time. There's no difficulty in visualizing the announcers, the people in the programs on radio. It's very difficult to visualize the person to whom you're speaking on telephone. I've talked to people like stockbrokers about this, who've said they've spent their lives talking to people on the telephone that they've never seen, and when by some chance they do encounter them, they get a terrific shock. Because they've had no image of them all these years and thought they knew them very well. The absence of image on the telephone is a great big positive potential of that medium that has never been tapped. It could be used for teaching mathematics to disadvantaged children and so on, to people who have no mathematical aptitude and so on. People don't study the media. They don't study the forms and their effects. They just study the inputs. The process of reading is a very hypnotic and soporific one. Most people like to read for that purpose. They don't read to make discoveries
or to have startling experiences. They have long accepted print as a lulling, soothing medium, and if you read both pages back and forth like that, you're soon asleep. If you're serious about your reading, you will have to go back over and over again to find out anything you've looked at. Now, this...
Is this historically true? Has not reading books caused men to act?
Reading books, the print created a technologically an environment called the public.
Yeah.
There was no public before print, and the public disappeared with electric surround into mass. Now, the difference between a public and a mass audience is nothing to do with cultural values. It has to do with the fact that a public consists of separate individuals, each with a private point of view. A mass audience has no point of view at all. It's so involved. People are so involved in one another, in speed of electric circuitry, that they have a sense of relationship and of responsibility to their society that is quite new. Involvement in the mass or electric circuitry creates a tremendous sense of responsibility and anxiety that is new. The public never had that because it was up to the individual. We respected the individual's private outlook in the case of the public. The public is literally created by individual readers, each looking at the same material from his own point of view. Under electric circuitry, there is no such public. There is no mere point of view. Let me mention...
The function of the person, this individual reading this book, continues to be an important function in your analysis.
Of course. Yeah. After all, I'm a professor of literature. The tendency is to stress dialogue rather than package. The old writer...
In TV...
The new kind of writing, beginning with symbolism, began to stress language and statement as a probe, not as a package of information. Prior to that, more than a century, the writer had thought of himself as packaging data and moving them along to readers. Then with people like Baudelaire, and more and more, people began to use statements for the purpose of exploring and probing the dimensions of experience. Yeah. And this is a non-literary procedure. The literary form, as it records and packages from a given point of view an experience, is very much like the third dimension perspective world of painting, which also disappeared at the same time as this perspective world in literature with Cézanne.
Mm-hmm.
He said, let us begin to paint as if we held things in our hands, not as if we were looking at them at all. Our print culture has for 500 years depressed all the sensory life except one sense. Our educational system has never educated people except in one sense, the visual sense. So we now have a media that stress all the senses, and we have no education to cope with this, the media at all. We still educate as if there were one medium.
Mm-hmm.
And our educational establishment is that much out of relation to what's going on in the world. We live in a time when people glorify the unconscious. And the most highly educated people of our time have spent much of their energies glorifying unawareness, the instinctive life. The ordinary commentator and reviewer always starts out from a point of view, and I don't.
Well, you have a point of view that you think it's a good thing for people to be aware of this process.
I think it takes an awful lot of hard work to find out what's going on, and you cannot find out what's going on by having a point of view. The man with a point of view is already detached, is already committed to non-exploration, non-involvement. He is merely there to insist upon the validity of, the consistency of his point of view, which is like having a vanishing point, a perspective, which belongs to Renaissance technology and culture. It does not belong to our time. A man in a space capsule does not have a point of view. A man in situation has a multitude of rapidly changing points of view, and this is much more relevant. If you want to understand what's happening to our world, think about the space capsule man.
if a person believes your analysis of what's going on, he will have a different attitude toward TV, toward society.
He won't have any views. He will have a probe in his hand. He can begin to do a little research. He can begin to look around. I put into his hand a probe, not a point of view.
You put into his hand a probe for the purpose, as you stated, of making him aware of this process that's going on so that he can have a dialogue in the course of the process which makes him a different person in relationship to it.
It will lead to many discoveries. He will be absolutely astonished at the number of discoveries he makes. He will never have thought it possible to have found out so many things in so short a time. And this is very exciting. Mm-hmm. Our whole educational system is shifting in that direction from instruction, imposing of stencils, to discovery. The whole elementary and secondary school system is gradually shifting to a world of discovery, probing, and exploration.
With your permission, let me stay with this just a moment longer. As I read your book, you're in the great Western tradition of trying to free man from something that is enslaving him. You say this thing there, is that right?
Yes.
Because he doesn't understand the process?
All right.
You're a liberator. You're a crusader, aren't you?
At the present time. But look, why don't we proceed to investigate a little more? I'm not a crusader, no. But I'm an explorer. I'm an investigator. You see, in an electric environment, and remember our environment is itself constituted by electric information, as sitting here or anywhere, electric information has now become the environment, and this means everything happens at once. In an electric environment, everything is simultaneous. It's very different from a railway environment, or from any preceding human environment of books or anything else. When everything happens at once, you cannot have a storyline, any connections between events. Our newspaper men discovered this a long time ago. You can have a dateline, but you can't have a storyline in a newspaper. Why? Because the telegraph sets it up at speed that is instantaneous and creates an environment, not a story. Now, when your whole world is transformed by electric speed into a simultaneous happening or environment, the older methods of contemplating that world become useless. The older training of observation and command becomes quite irrelevant because it was all based on one thing happening at a time in a sequence.
Yeah.
How do you cope with an environment in which everything happens at once?
Mr. McMillan, could I read you a few quotations which have been attributed to you and ask you if they're correct?
I assure you they are not correct because that's mere matching, and I don't work that way, but I'll be happy to discuss them.
Speaking of your writings, you say, I don't pretend to understand them. After all, my stuff is very difficult. I don't agree or disagree with my points. I don't agree or disagree with anything I say myself.
That is correct.
On TV, Hitler wouldn't have lasted 10 minutes, and if it were not for the hot media, the war in Vietnam would be over in an hour. These are all substantially
correct. Well, why not pause and deal with them?
Voting has had it. We have to do better. It is a fragmented approach and so forth.
Yeah, well, why not discuss these?
Well, what I wanted to ask you about them is, do you, like some other social commentators in history, enjoy pulling our leg a bit and playing puck?
I will use any method at all for getting awareness and attention going.
You don't really mean this type of statement.
I mean every word of them, of course.
You mean in a literal sense.
I will explain any of those. Rationality has, for many people, the connotation of uniformity and connectedness. I don't follow you means I don't think what you're saying is rational.
Yeah.
This is nothing to do with rationality. It has much to do with visual space. Visual space is uniform, continuous, and connected. The rational man in our Western culture is a visual man. Once he steps off the visual track, he is in an irrational morass. The fact that most experience has no rationality or visuality in it at all is lost on him. Rationality and visuality are really interchangeable terms, but we don't live in a visual world anymore, therefore...
I have the 5-minute signal.
And I really don't have any strong feelings about this because it's a situation that will tend to correct itself in time, but but there's a lot of waste in the meanwhile. For centuries, the only kind of skill or grammar or literacy that was taught was that connected with the writing, reading and writing itself. All the other skills and technologies of the environment were accepted as merely environmental and taken for granted. Today, we have, because these things have stepped up in many of their developments, in many of their manifestations, we have to understand the language and grammars of many media. And this... It is rather fantastic, isn't it, when you think of the number of hours that people spend in front of film or television, for them to know nothing about the processes of making these things, or nothing about the means available for themselves to express themselves. So, by typing. But the McLaren Welders makes a tremendous break with ordinary film in this way, that by painting directly onto the film, you make the audience, as it were, the screen, instead of making the audience the camera eye. And so the child then, by drawing directly onto film, has the sense of mastery over the whole world. It's like a composer writing a melody. He makes a world. The composer making a melody doesn't try to make a world that corresponds to some other world. He just etches or makes with sound a world. McLaren, when he draws directly onto film, makes a world. He isn't photographing a situation which corresponds to some other situation. So this switch from matching to making is a drastic one in terms of the learning process. It switches altogether, again, from classified data, from mere matching knowledge, to a world of actual discovery and actual knowing of forms. I think you couldn't find a larger switchover in the whole history of education.